Hello, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of Muscle for Life. I am your host, Mike Matthews, and today's episode is on the topic of training to failure, which has been debated for decades now, is still debated. Questions like, is it necessary? Is it practical? Is it safe? Expert opinion all over the place, has always been, still is. It ranges from one extreme of very low volume, maximum intensity beyond failure training, like Mike Mentzer's training style, for example, which is having a bit of a moment again, at least on social media. And then you can find jacked experts who advocate for the exact opposite: high volume, low intensity, never even close to failure training. And of course, you can find every degree and every permutation in between. And so then the question, of course, is which of all of these philosophies is right, or at least the most right? And more importantly, which is right specifically for you, your circumstances, your goals? That is, are you training hard enough to efficiently and effectively achieve your goals? Well, in this episode, renowned expert Lyle McDonald answers those questions and more, including what true muscular failure is, physiologically speaking, technically speaking, defining the term specifically, because there are different definitions for muscular failure. And if you have the wrong definition, that can compromise the effectiveness of your training. In this episode, Lyle also talks about why proximity to failure matters more than many other programming variables that many people pay a lot of attention to, like training load and rep ranges and rep techniques like drop sets and supersets and forced reps and so on. Lyle also explains why many people could benefit from more proximity to failure in their training rather than less and more. And in case you are not familiar with Lyle, he is a health and fitness researcher and writer, and he's really one of the godfathers of the evidence-based fitness space. His work has greatly influenced my own, especially in the beginning of my career. And that's why I've had him on the podcast several times. And I always enjoy hearing his thoughts about how we can get fitter, leaner, and stronger using science-based diet and training methods. Lyle McDonald has returned. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been, I don't know, probably over two years. I know your email was sitting in my inbox since, I want to say, 2021. And I kind of checked out of the industry and decided it was time to get back. And thanks for having me after I kind of blew everybody off for so long. So
yeah, cool. No, I was excited to when you emailed, I was excited because I wanted to have this conversation. I thought it was interesting.
Yeah. All right. Well, cool.
And so what that is proximity to failure is I guess the broad heading. Why don't we start with explaining why this is even important? Why are we going to talk about this for an hour or whatever?
Yeah. So first, some definitions, because I think this is where a lot of the confusion comes from. Like when we say, talk about training to failure, like what does that actually mean in either a practical sense or physiological sense? Because over the, decades at this point, there has been a longstanding debate over this issue. And I don't think Arthur Jones back in the 70s necessarily started it, but he really brought it sort of to a head in terms of recommending, you know, with the HIT guys that you need to take each set to concentric failure. But what does that mean? And there's been multiple definitions. And this is part of the problem, right? If you go back all the way back to Delorme, and we're talking about the early 20th century, and he was one of probably the early people with any sort of logic to training. And he would recommend 3 sets of 10. And the first set was at 50% of your 10 repetition max, the most you could do, the heaviest weight you could do 10 repetitions with. And then set two was at 75%. Set three was at 10 RM. And then there was this progression system. But even then, he defined it as, you know, a 10 RM was the maximum weight that you could lift through the full range of motion. And that is sort of a generalized definition. But since then, there have been others. In terms of, one is technical failure, which is you only go to the point that your technique starts to degrade. And a lot of studies use this. Mm-hmm. And in a practical sense, I don't disagree. I don't want people going past the point that their technique is failing. But at least in a practical sense, in a research sense, in a training sense, I think that introduces a really complicated variable. It introduced, well, two variables. One is, how do we define this, right? Most of these studies don't ever say what that means. Well, we have them do back squats until the point of technical failure. Well, what does that mean? Is it when you are squatting very upright and you tip over? How many degrees? Is it when your knees start to break in? Like, what are we defining that as? Number two, it introduces the issue of technical competency, right? I read a study and they go, well, we had people that had been training for 2 years consistently and we had them squat to failure. Or beginner studies are even funnier. Yeah, right. You're going to take a beginner who can barely, their technical failure, or compare that to someone, a high-level power lifter, a high-level Olympic lifter, whose technique doesn't break under any conditions. How close they're getting to actual physiological muscular failure, which is what I'll get to next, are going to be very different things. A highly qualified power lifter with beautiful technique may be able to get however many more reps just because their technique is more stabilized under load. Then there's my favorite failure, which is volitional failure, which basically means stopping the
set. I don't want to do this anymore.
Well, I mean, that's a set like volitional. It is when the person decides that they would fail on the next repetition. But to me, that's an utterly ridiculous argument for the reasons that I'll explain. Is that, so does that mean that if I do two reps and I decide that my next rep would be failure, even if I could technically do eight more, is that the same stimulus as actually going for eight more reps? Because that's what that seems to imply. Well, it's you stopped when volitionally you decided you were done, which is also the issue. We get into what exercise is being done. How good is the person's internal drive? Someone with a lot of years under the bar with extremely high drive can push way harder muscularly into that before they just, most people, and again, I've been in the gym for 30 years. I'm old. Well, I've been in the gym for damn near 40 years, but 30 years professionally. I've watched a lot of people squat. And it is interesting. It's better now, people's technique. I'm seeing a lot more technically sound squats because social media is both good and bad in this regard, but more people are at least being exposed to better technique. But I've watched a lot of people squat. And most people, when they decide they've had enough, is nowhere close to what I would consider in terms of bar speed, in terms of those things. So,
I mean, I would say that that would apply, at least in the gym that I go to.
Sure. That's
I would say most exercises, most sets of most people. I mean, I don't pay too much attention to what other people, but if I just look at the movie reel in my head and think about, you know, how people, the general intensity of the training,
it's
not particularly high.
Research shows that people...
It's like 2 or 3 hours of a lot of submaximal work.
Of basically doing a lot of warm-ups. And I'll talk about bar speed here in a second, but if we're talking about muscular adaptations, and here I'm going to focus on growth, because strength is a different thing because you've got neurological factors and technical factors. So muscle growth. And we talk about what is needed to stimulate growth in muscle fibers. All that matters, as far as I'm concerned, is how close the target muscle was to muscular failure. But what does that mean? What does that actually mean to fail? And basically, all right, let's say you're doing a leg extension. Let's just simplify it, right? All you're doing is from here to the top and back again. You've got whatever weight is on the bar, 100 units, 100 pounds, whatever, 10 plates, whatever it is on the machine. That requires you to generate some amount of force. Now, you start the set. Beginning of the set, like let's say it takes 100 units of force, just abstract units, to lift that weight through the full range of motion. You start the set. Your muscle's fresh. You're recovered. You can generate 150 units of force. Weight's moving real easily. So here's the 100 units you have to get to do a full rep. 150, 140, every rep, your force output is getting lower because the muscle's getting tired. At the point that you can do 110 units of force, it'll start moving slow. At 105, you're working. At 100, you can barely finish the repetition. At such a point that muscle force production cannot achieve 100 units of force, you cannot complete the repetition. That is what I would, in a purely physiological sense, the muscle doesn't care when your technique fell apart. The muscle doesn't care when you decided to quit from the standpoint of sending an adaptive signal to the skeletal muscle, the target muscle. All that matters is how much mechanical tension it had to generate over a certain number of repetitions, there's a metabolic work component. So let's say, just to, as a comparison, let's say that we know that in a back squat, that your quads, let's say you're using it to target your quads, that they could generate enough force to perform 10 repetitions with that weight before they would physiologically not be able to generate enough force. Well, if your technique falls apart at rep 5 because you don't have stabilized technique, well, that was technical failure. Does that mean your quads experienced a stimulus? No. They're 5 reps from physiological muscular failure. Let's say that you stop it rep 5 because you don't feel like doing it. Does that mean your muscle magically knows, well, hey, it's still failure, even though, no, all muscle senses tension and metabolic work. All the muscle knows is that it was nowhere close to its limits. So to me, the best definition of failure in a physiological sense is an inability to complete a full repetition despite providing maximal effort. If you just give up, that's not failure. It's volitional failure, but I think that's a dumb definition, because your low back gave out on back squats and your technique fell apart, or you gave up 5 reps from what your quads would experience, right? And this is one of the problems, and we're going to talk about reps in reserve and what that means. And just again, so this point will make sense. Reps in reserve is a way of defining how many reps you are from hitting muscular failure. All right, so again, we'll go back to leg extension to simplify. Let's say we know that you could complete 10 repetitions and then could not complete repetition 11. Repetition 11 would be the failure rep. And we do tend to conflate those. We tend to say that the 10th rep was failure. Technically, the 11th rep was the failure repetition.
Yeah. Whether you tried or not, yeah.
Right. And even that, like going, well, I just think I would have failed on the next rep. Like the only true way to know you achieved muscular failure is to try to do the next repetition and be unable to complete it in the strictest sense.
And although with enough experience, I mean,
well, yes, yeah,
you can develop a bit of a sense for it. But
yes, you can absolutely develop a sense for it based on bar speed and past experience and the amount of pain you're willing to put through. Yeah. So reps in reserve is a way of defining how many repetitions away from failure you were. So 0 reps in reserve mean you could not have done another repetition. Right. So if 10 reps was 0 reps in reserve, you would not have completed repetition 11. 1 rep in reserve mean that you're one rep away. That would be 9 reps. 2 reps in reserve is 8, 7, 6, 5. Okay, so that's what reps in reserve is. And I know we're gonna sort of talk about that later. And what you typically see with that reps in reserve is that there is a change at bar speed. And somewhere, depending on the movement, depending on the person, somewhere between, 2 and 4 reps in reserve, you tend to see bar speed start to slow. And that's pretty much every study in the history of ever. So, I know what I was getting at. So let's go back to the squat thing. Studies will talk about, we had them squat to 2 reps in reserve. Let's just assume for the sake of argument that was true. If we're trying to train our quads for hypertrophy, we don't know for sure that the quadriceps experience 2 reps in reserve, right? We tend to really confuse these issues. The goal is not to take the exercise to a certain reps in reserve or failure, whatever your goal is. The goal from a stimulus standpoint is to take the target muscle to a certain reps in reserve. And this is the big problem I have with all these studies using complex movements, using back squat, using definitions of failure that have nothing to do with actual muscular failure. Again, if I put someone in a back squat and their technique is bad, they're 5 reps in reserve from technical failure, might be 10 for their quads. I mean, I don't know. The thing is, I can't say.
Yeah.
If someone has really bad levers for squatting because they have long femurs and they're bent over,
that's me.
I can almost guarantee you that 2 reps in reserve was in their low back.
Yep.
Whether or not their quads got there, they might not have. I can't say, and that's the thing. We don't actually know, but we do know that people with bad levers don't tend to build big legs with squats. They get way more when they take their low back out of it.
Or you just make a mistake because you're deep in a set. It's hard. You're a good weightlifter, but you shoot your hips up faster than you should have.
Yes.
And then it's a grinder, and then you think, like, well, yes. I guess that's it. I barely completed that.
And that might have been quads. It might have not been. It might have been any number of things. Whereas if I put you on a leg press where we could define technical failure a little more strictly, not hitting the same depth, knees, but there's really no technical failure to occur. Yeah. If I take you to 2 reps in reserve, and for now, let's say I have a magic wand to know when you got there, or based on bar speed, I can have a pretty good idea that that was two reps reserved for the target muscle. And if I put you on a leg extension and have you do it to two reps in reserve, I can say without debate that it was your quads. So when we talk about all this, we get into all these competing variables, and I just find a lot of the definitions of failure, well, technical failure, could be because your technique sucks. Could be because, like you said, an accident happened. It could be that your low back gave out. Well, if your goal is to target the quads, how is training it? I mean, deadlifts are even worse, like this whole thing with a deadlift for, and I've asked people, okay, what is the deadlift train? And the answer is not everything, because there is no everything muscle, right? Like what typically gives out on deadlifts when people do them for reps? Could be grip, say they use traps. Usually low back, which if you're trying to train low back is fine, but does that mean the upper back got a stimulus? Does that mean the legs got a stimulus? We don't know. It might have or it might not have. So in a physiological sense, from the standpoint of what the muscle experiences in terms of tension and metabolic work, only valid definition I think is the inability to complete another full range of repetition, again, despite maximal effort. Now that gets into other things. You brought up experience. Learning to push hard is a skill that requires being pushed hard by a sadistic coach like myself, or just doing it over time. And I've given people experiments in the videos that they never do because they don't want to have to admit that I'm right. They go, look, when you think you're at failure, you're probably not.
Yep. I do that regularly in my training.
As long as it's
just as a rule. I mean, I avoid it on certain exercises. When I was younger, I would do it. I would be more willing to do it in a back squat or just in a barbell deadlift, but now not as much. However, if I'm doing an isolation exercise, just something where I'm not concerned about injury, then I often will, out of, let's say I'm doing three or four sets for that exercise, I often, at least in one of them, just to keep myself honest, I have my little RIR that I'm trying to get in and go, well, let me see. I think I could do one more, but maybe I can do more than one. Let me go for it.
Right. And people often really surprise themselves. When I put up those videos on my years ago about that, several people in my group were like, I thought I was at failure. And I went back in after watching your videos and I put 30 more pounds on and got 7 more reps than I thought. I'm like, until you really had someone either do it yourself or have someone really talk you through it rep by rep. Yep. You know, and I just said, get on a safe exercise, get on a hammer chest press or leg extension, something you're not going to get wrecked if something goes super wrong. It's like, as long as the weight is still moving, keep pushing.
Yep.
And after you do that rep, try it again and keep, as long as it's moving the tiniest bit, keep putting again. You're not doing this all the time. People, when I did that series, they were like, oh, Lyle, I could advocate failure. I'm like, go back. I said, actually explicitly not. That I'm not recommending this. But what I'm saying is that to know where it is, you have to actually experience it. And that's the other problem with the reps and reserve thing. And I think this leads us into the main thing you wanted to talk about is it has been shown repeatedly that people's estimates of their reps and reserve is generally pretty bad, but gets better with experience, right? You take beginners, and the studies are weird because like you're in the middle of a set and they go, how many more reps do you think you can get? And then they have them keep repping but that's the only way to do it, right?
Yeah.
Or what I tell people, I go, look, pick a weight that you think is your 10 rep max that you can only get 10 reps with and just go see what happens where you keep and I'm like, maybe you're right, but based on 30 years of experience in the gym, I can guarantee you in 99% of the case, you're wrong. What you think is your 10 RM is not anywhere close. So as people get experience, they get much better within, a rep or two. Although I do think, and maybe you've done this frequently in my head, like if I were to ask you, hey, Mike, any more reps do you have during a set? And you went 2, you'd probably only get 2.
Yeah.
Because you feel like programming.
Like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, absolutely. I do it. This is so dumb. I'll superset leg extensions and leg curls. And like, I try to keep the reps about the same just because I like, my workouts are drawn up more for aesthetic purposes than anything else. I just like, this is 4x8. It should also be 4x8 because I like symmetry. But it's like, oh, well, I failed at 8 on that one. Somehow I'll always seem to fail at 8 on the other one. And how much of it is real and how much of it is just self. But that is a problem with this. And it hasn't been
I've experienced it even more. So currently I'm just doing a maintenance routine 3 days a week, kind of a push pull legs with a little bit of extra volume for arms. And, but before that, for about 2 years, I was pushing pretty hard, 5 days a week, maybe 70 to 90 minutes, and going for primarily just gaining strength in the big exercises, blah, 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 and had it periodized and was more, I would say, systematic about how I was going. Because maintenance, you can kind of just have fun, lift some heavy weights, get a pump, and you're fine, right? Yeah. And so previously, though, at the end of the training blocks were 4 months, I believe, 3 or 4 months. And at the end, I would do a round of AMRAPs on the big exercises to see if I've made any progress over the last few months. And so, okay, so, you know, I'm going to put whatever it is, 275 or 295 on the back squat and see how many reps I can do. Right. And I was doing that for about 2 years. And something I noticed is that on those AMRAP days, which I was kind of excited for because it was fun, and I felt almost like that reminded me of playing sports as a kid growing up. Yeah, that competitive feel. Just, you know, okay, this is the day. I've been working 3 or 4 months, and let's see what I can do. And consistently, I would outperform my expectations, and my expectations were based on the data I had on my training leading up to those days. Where if you were to look at my numbers, you would have predicted that I would have gotten 6 reps or whatever, and I'll go in there and get 9. And it just would happen consistently. I do it on the squat, deadlift, and bench press. Those are the 3 exercises I would use to test my whole body strength.
Right.
And there was definitely a psychological component. There was expectations and just being excited and looking forward to it. And that seemed to add several reps to whatever weight it was.
And that is, you know, that's the other issue. This gets into, like, I see it as, like, you know, there's the whole psychosocial model of pain. People have different abilities to push, you know, into the darkness. And there is that effect. You know, Arthur Jones famously said, when you think you're at failure, and he's like, if I stepped up and put a gun in your face and said, get another repetition, you'd probably find a way. And I don't disagree with that. But again, that is a function of learning to push hard. And that is something that it is a skill, and it does have to happen over time. You know, when I used to train general population, it's the same thing. And it would be like, you know, they would be like a few weeks in, and they'd be like 8, 9, 10. And I'd be like, just try a couple more. And they'd get it, and I'd stop them. Like, I wouldn't grind them into dirt. And they, what did they learn? Okay, where I think I'm done, I can go a little bit further. And you do it over time. I remember a famous story, some Olympic lifting coach, and he had an athlete, he gave him 5x5 in the back squat, and the athlete went 4x5 and then 3 on the last set. And the coach, and this is not something I would recommend a lot, said, do the whole thing again. And he made him repeat the entire workout, and he got all 5x5. Now, that's awful, and I don't believe in punishment as training, but what did the athlete learn? When you think you're done, you're probably not. But it does. It takes practice. And certainly, again, anyone listening to this, I am not advocating everyone train to failure all the time, despite some lies that were made by people that were too ego-driven to admit that I was right about something. And I won't mention who. That was what I checked out of the industry, when someone just bold-faced lied about me and nobody brought. People are still whining about stuff I said a decade ago, but they don't care that this person is telling a bold-faced lie. And that's when I checked out for 2 years. I'm like, I give up. I quit. Regardless, I'm not recommending that you do this all the time. It's not for everybody. There are different psychologies. I'm not saying that failure is the only way to train. But if you're going to follow some workout that says you need to be working at 2 reps in reserve, you got to know where it is. That means spending some amount of time learning not only what true failure is, but how to get there.
I want to follow up on that in particular. I do want, though, to just quickly have you comment for people who don't understand why proximity to failure is, in some ways, it's just as important in terms of programming as
absolutely. How
many reps you're going to do and how much weight you're going to use. Like, these things actually need to go together to produce effective training.
Right. So this gets, without getting super, super into the weeds.
Yeah.
This is, right, so we have, simplistically, 2 types of muscle fire. We've got type 1, which are more endurance, smaller. And then we've got type 2, which are the higher threshold fibers, more for force and power. Now, when we start to exercise, they tend to be recruited in an orderly fashion, something called Henneman's size principle, based on force requirements, right? So if you start brisk walking, it's type 1. Jogging, you start to get some, you know, a little bit more type 1 at some speed, early type 2, sprinting all out, till eventually you get full fiber recruitment. And you can also get this with fatigue, right? Like if you are running hard early in the workout, you may be recruiting predominantly type 1, but as you start to fatigue and it gets harder and harder and harder, those will come in due to fatigue. So in the weight room, the same thing happens, right? If you're doing, let's say you're doing low load training and you're doing 20%, 25% of 1RM, that stuff. In the early part of the set, it's only type 1 muscle fiber. And it won't be till near the end that you actually require the type 2 muscle fibers to be recruited. And what it ends up being, and I wrote about this forever ago, those highest threshold muscle fibers, which have the most potential for growth, don't get recruited at maximum until roughly 80 to 85% of 1RM, that's about 5 to 8 repetitions, or in higher repetition sets, taken closer to failure. So there's kind of two ways to get full muscle recruitment, which is you can start real heavy and do lower repetitions, or you can start with a lighter set, like a set of 12, and take it to, and what actually ends up happening when they've looked at this with like EMG and muscle fiber recruitment is if you do a set of 15 to failure, and you do a set of 5 at 85%, that's a limit set.
Which for people listening, that's going to be close to failure for most people. Yeah, 85 for 5 is maybe you have one more. Yeah.
Yeah, depending on the person, some will get one less. You know, there's a little variation. But what you see is that in terms of recruitment, the final 5 repetitions of the 15 rep set is neurologically equivalent to that 5, that set of 5. And we've seen the same thing in the low load training. We know that with that low load training, you have to go to muscular failure to make it work, because that's the only way to get full fiber recruit. The last 5 repetitions of that 25 rep set is neurologically, physiologically the equivalent of that heavy set of 5. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that 5s are the way to train for growth or whatever. But what you see when you start looking at all the studies is, okay, in sets of 8, I guess you're doing a set of 8 at 80% of 1RM. That's about an 8 rep max. By rep 2 or 3, you'll get full recruitment. You might get it from rep 1, 2. It's hard to really say. It'll depend on the person. But with heavier sets, you don't have to go to failure to get growth. Because let's say you do a set of 8 at a 10 RM, right? 2 reps in reserve. At least the last 3 or 4 of those repetitions, 3 or 4 reps of that 8 rep set will be a full recruitment. Whereas if you're using low load training, you do have to go to failure to get growth, because you don't get full recruitment until those last 5. Then if you look at it in terms of, if you start comparing the reps in reserve and look at it in terms of bar speed, what you basically see is that regardless of how many reps you take to failure, set of 15, a set of 5, or even a max single, the last 5 reps of the set of 15 move about the same as the last 5 of the 5 reps of the set of 5.
Yeah.
And the last rep of each set looks exactly like a 1RM. Because what is a 1 repetition maximum? It is the ability to generate force. If you got to generate 100 units, you can do 101. Well, when did I say failure occurs during a higher rep set? It's when your momentary force production is that level. So if all you can generate is 100 at the end of a set of 15, the end of a set of 5, at the 1RM, of course they'll look the same, because your force production is identical to what's required.
Yeah.
So the proximity reps in reserve matters in the sense of, If you're doing a set of 10 with 5 reps in reserve, you're getting maybe one repetition under full recruitment conditions. Now, if you're doing a set of 5 at a 5RM, you're getting all 5 reps. And that gets into, you know, the effective reps model, and I don't want to delve too deep. The idea there being that the growth stimulus occurs from the total number of effective reps, being defined here as reps done under conditions of full recruitment. Now, I'm not saying this model is right. We need some more direct data. But to me, A makes the most logical sense, because let's think about this. If you don't recruit a muscle fiber, it cannot grow. Like, sort of like by definition, right? Now, we could make the argument that, yeah, doing all those submaximal sets, you're maybe getting some type 1 muscle growth, but we know that they don't grow very much. You cannot recruit, you cannot stimulate a muscle fiber to adapt if you don't recruit it in the first place and force it produce mechanical tension. This to me seems like the most logical statement in the world. And yet somehow people are still debating this, right? If you do not, and say it a third time, so if you do not recruit a muscle fiber during an activity, during a training, it cannot grow. And that gets back to the squat example. Let's say that 2 reps in reserve on the squat are really 5 reps in reserve on your quads. You didn't get into full recruitment for the quads. Maybe you did for the low back or the upper back or another muscle group. That cannot possibly give you an optimal growth stimulus for the quads. I'm not saying it doesn't give none, but without recruiting those high threshold fibers. And you typically don't see that occurring. Like I said, on a set of 5, it's from about rep 1.
Yeah.
On a set of 10 to failure, it's probably rep 6 through 10.
Now, what about in the squat, though? Let's say you have somebody who's pretty good at squatting and they're doing sets of 5 or 6, or maybe sure. They're doing sets of 8, and right. They have pretty good form and it is predominantly a quadriceps exercise, meaning they're doing it right.
Yes.
In that case, then would you say that it could function?
Oh, no. Yes. I mean, no, absolutely. Like, don't mishear me. I'm not saying that squats are inherently bad for quads. I'm saying that telling people to go to technical failure if they have bad levers, it may or may not be. It just adds another component to the definition of failure. Because clearly, I mean, I got short femurs. I was built very well for squatting. I could squat even in flats, very upright. I could take it to the point. I mean, and I did. Like, true failure in the squat means descending into the bottom and getting stuck and having to dump the bar on the pins. And I'm not recommending that. Did I do it? Absolutely. Would I recommend it to most? Absolutely not, because it's a good way to get wrecked. But yeah, if you are built for squats, and this is what you see, like we could do a whole nother hour on my ranting about exercise selection. When someone says that squats are great for quads, go look at their biomechanics. I guarantee you they're built for the movement. It is a good exercise for them. Find someone who says squats are not good for quads, and either they don't know how to squat well, or they're not built for it. So it's a matter of context. For some people, squats can be a good exercise. Or like look at you know, the average Olympic lifter, but they all have about the same biomechanics. Yeah. They're all built very, very, very similarly, which is short with short femurs. So yeah, of course, for them, it's a great movement. And if they're doing a set of 5, and they're doing, you know, to the first bar speed drop, which is probably 2 to 3 reps in reserve. Absolutely. And they just do a ton of volume. So yeah, it absolutely can be. Same thing with bench press. People who say, the bench is great for pecs. Go look at how they're built. They're always barrel chested with short arms. And for them, failure, and they tend to have very even musculature, right? If they've got short arms with strong triceps, it's not their triceps failing on the bench, right? Again, you got big, lanky arms like me. If I'm bench pressing, assuming I've got good technique, and I was very stable because I did it for years and years and years, like, okay, and I hit 2 reps in reserve, well, what failed? What was 2? Was it my triceps? Was it my pecs? We don't know. It depends on the person. It depends on their biomechanics. It depends on their levers. Whereas if I do a pec deck and I go tilt, fail, I know it was my pecs that failed, generally. So yeah, that's just an individual thing. But if we're looking at it from pure physiology and how close you need to be to failure, you have to get at least some number of effective reps. Now, as a quick tangent, which is why I do think this model makes more sense, this gets back to what you said as a variable. We've had, a 30-year argument, and certainly in the last 5 years, about sets and reps and volume and frequency and this and that and the other and all these different studies. And when you look at them in the aggregate, which you always have to do, and you start looking at the different things that people have made work, sets and reps don't matter. 3 sets of 10 at a 20 rep max, that's a warm-up, right? You look at the Cody Hahn study that Mike Isertel was on that did built up to 32 sets. They were doing repeat sets of 10 at 4 reps in reserve with like a 10-minute break because of the way they set up the workout. So they did a ton of warm-ups, and the growth actually turned out to not even be fiber growth. It was fluid. It was the sarcoplasmic growth, because they were not getting ineffective reps, right? If you start to look at different systems of training, whether depending on the total volumes, the sets and the reps, failure, all these other variables, right? So I've seen the number thrown around that, let's say, 25 effective reps is optimal, like per workout. I'm not saying
for an individual muscle group.
For an individual muscle group. Thank you. Yes. So I'm not saying that it is or isn't. Like, I know Chris Beardsley has thrown in that number out, and I've read the article he wrote on it a dozen times, and no one can explain to me where that number comes from. It doesn't matter. Let's just assume that
it seems kind of low.
Well, but is it? per, like, if you're talking about maximal muscular contractions, that's 5 sets of 5. I mean, that's not, but regardless, okay, so let's say it's 30, like whatever, under maximal conditions, right? Yeah. I'm not saying total reps, saying total maximal contractions. Okay, so let's look at, say, 5 sets of 8 to failure, or whatever. Let's look at sets of 8 to failure. We know that the last 4 to 5 repetitions will be under, you know, effective reps. So you're looking at, so about 5 to 6 sets of 8. All right, now let's back off to 2 reps in reserve. Now each set you're doing sets of 8 at a 10 rep max. Now we know that each set is going to give you about 3 effective reps.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to need about 8 to 10 sets per workout.
Yeah.
Now, let's say you go to
like, which also is kind of the normal prescription for an individual muscle group. I've said the same thing, that if you're going to train one muscle group in a workout, or however many muscle groups going to train, you probably don't need to do more than 10 to 12 total sets in that session. Right. If you think you do, you're probably not training hard enough.
Well, right. But then, so then let's say you look at, like, there was a study and it did like leg extensions, and one group used 3 minutes of rest and the other group used 1 minute or something like that. And what they did was they took the number of reps, like they equated the metabolic work between legs, and they found that growth was the same. But what they also found was that submaximal group, sorry, that's what it was. It was that one group did like 2 reps short of failure. Or maybe it's whatever. It was something like that. But they needed about 50% more sets. Okay, yeah. So now if you take someone who's running around on a short rest interval and is getting lower quality sets, they need about 15 sets per muscle group. Well, in my mind, looking at it that way in terms of the total number of maximal contractions per workout helps to, it builds a unified model. Like, yeah, if you're going to go all out, if you're going to go absolute Dorian Yates level muscular failure, 4 to 5, maybe 6 sets, depending on the muscle group, is about all you're going to have. Like, anything more than that is just going to be wasted volume, and you're not going to have the energy to do it. If you prefer, if you're not good to go going to failure, and some people aren't, make no mistake, they don't have the psychological drive, they don't enjoy it, they get burnt out on it. I'm not saying that's the way to train. They go, all right, I want to be a couple reps short of failure. Well, they're going to need somewhere between 8, 10, maybe 12 sets. If you want someone who's going to do the old school short rest interval, low quality training, or some of these high volume studies, my favorite that people take so super seriously is a study by Brigato that compared 16, 24, and 32 sets per week. It was one of these ridiculous volume studies. So they did 8 sets of 10 RM back squat on 60 seconds. Bull crap. Just show me.
I'd like to see a video of that.
But they called it technical failure. Yeah. So I guarantee you, like, if you went to true muscular failure, even if you stopped short of getting pinned, by set 3, you wouldn't get up off the floor.
Yeah, correct.
But, and then they did leg extensions 8 to 10 RM on 60 seconds. Yeah. And they found that, yeah, you basically need massive volumes to compensate for either low intensity or low quality training. And if we start mapping it out and looking at it in terms of that, in terms of effective repetitions, a lot of the supposed contradictions regarding set and rep recommendations and all these different types of training systems will go away. Actually, let me add one more thought to that, because I think you had another thing that's being apparently promoted. You look at things like rest pause, like MyoReps by Borsch, Fagerly, Blade, and I've known him for 20 years, and I'm probably still mispronouncing his last name, and I do apologize for that. Dog Crap by Dante Trudell, which was a very similar thing. I do believe Blade was actually the first to talk about effective reps, and this was back on my forum back in the 2000s. And the idea here, and Dog Crap, which is another little bit different rest pause system, very similar. So in this, you take that first set to concentric failure, right? The idea is to get maximal recruitment. In Blade's version, you stop at the first rep speed drop, I believe. And then you rest, you take a very short rest interval, like 15 seconds, like a number of big breaths, and you go again. And the thing is that in that short rest interval, those maximally recruited fibers don't de-recruit, right? When you go back, you're not starting early in that size principle thing. So the idea is get to the maximum number of effective reps in that one drop set. And again, Blade said years ago that one myo rep set, a typical myo rep set, you do like a set of eight to within one or two reps in reserve, rest 15 seconds, four or five more, three or four more, one or two more. You're getting like total 20 total reps.
Yeah.
But like 12 of them would be considered effective reps. And he said years ago that one myo rep set was the equivalent of about 3 to 4 straight sets. So if you were to do two myo rep sets or two dog crap sets, you are getting essentially that same 12, maybe as many as 15 effective reps per set. So in those two dropped sets, you're getting the same 24 to 30 or so effective reps. So again, we've got to do a couple of drop sets, which is lower volume, but the same number of effective reps. You can do 4 to 5 sets, 8 all out failure. You can do 10 to 12 sets at 2 reps in reserve, or you can do 15 sets per workout to make up for low quality.
And do you subscribe to that position that one myo rep or one dog crap set is the work equivalent, line equivalent of?
I think there was actually a study. Remember,
like, for the purpose of not, let's say, not just maintaining because that's so easy, but actually trying to gain muscle and strength.
I mean, in practice, it sure seemed to work. I mean, I do think in Dante's system, I do think the maximally loaded stretch added a little bit of volume. But I mean, practically, both of them had, their people had success with that system.
Yeah.
So, like, again, I'm not saying that the effective reps model is correct, and data may come out tomorrow that says it's absolutely wrong, but it makes logical sense to me because, again, you cannot train a fiber that has not been recruited. To get maximal type 2 fiber recruitment, you need to get into what we are calling the effective rep range, which is, in depending on the intensity, could be, again, 5 reps of a 5 rep set, the last 5 reps of an 8 rep set, the last 5 reps of it. And I think it also explains why so many different systems have just worked over the years, right? Yeah. People have gotten bigger doing higher repetitions. They've gotten bigger doing lots of low repetition sets. And I think if you math it out this way, a lot of those contradictions fall away. Now, what I would like to see, I want to see where, like, is there a per workout optimal range where beyond that, you're just doing junk volume? You know, I think we go back to the Wernbaum meta-analysis from forever ago, 20 years ago. And he put together a zillion pieces of data, and admittedly wasn't, not a lot in advance. And he showed that approximately 40 to 70 total repetitions per workout. And most of these studies were using supposedly failure. Like, I'm not going to go pull 80 studies to figure it out, but presumably, you know, it would, and was gave the optimal growth, and less than that was less than optimal. More than that was actually didn't give the maximal growth. You know, and if you're looking at that, okay, if we're doing, talking about sets of eight, you're looking at somewhere between 5 to 8 maximum sets of eight. You're looking at somewhere between 6 to 10 at 2 reps in reserve. Like, it all sort of, you know, it all kind of falls out of that. So yeah, so then I guess the next question becomes, like, how close to failure do you actually need to be?
If you like what I'm doing here on the podcast and elsewhere, and if you want to help me do more of it, please do check out my sports nutrition company, Legion, because while you don't need supplements to build muscle, lose fat, get healthy, the right ones can help. And which ones in particular can help you achieve your fitness goals faster? Well, maybe supplements like my all-natural pre-workout, Pulse that increases energy, improves mood, sharpens focus, boosts strength and endurance, and reduces fatigue. Or maybe my all-natural post-workout supplement, Recharge, that increases muscle and strength gain, improves post-workout recovery, and reduces muscle soreness. What's more, right now over at buylegion.com, that's BUYlegion.com, Pulse and Recharge are on sale for 25% off. That is all flavors of both products, as well as Pulse with caffeine and without caffeine. We have 2 versions. So if you want some help training harder, recovering better, gaining faster, head over to buylegion.com now, place an order for Pulse and Recharge, save 25%, and check them out.
I want to quickly ask you about rest times, just for people wondering. So you had commented on these shorter 1 minute rest times being suboptimal. And because it's suboptimal, you have to make up for that with more volume.
Sure.
I'm just thinking with some listeners who are wondering why that is, and then also trying to square that with the circle now of this dog crap myorep approach.
Yeah,
it's even less rest, and that actually is effective. You know, so if you want to just quickly explain how does intraset rest time
different than the mini set thing? And I think it's just a matter of duration. Like at a minute, you're gonna get some recovery between the sets, so you're not going into the second set with maintaining maximal recruitment. Just because it's not going to be like it does seem like a contradiction. And I think it's simply that with that 10-15 second rest, you're not getting enough recovery that when you start the next set, you're having to start again from submaximal
baseline
levels. And you see this in other activities as well, right? Like you're doing an interval training and you're doing all out minutes. Like, you know, if you're doing a minute and you gas, like if you take 10 seconds, you can keep going a little bit longer. If you take a minute, the first 30 seconds is very easy again. Like, trust me, if you do a dog crap set and take it to failure, as soon as you start that mini set, the rep speed starts out slow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I've done quite a bit over the years.
Sure.
And
whereas if you take a minute,
I think those sets are like 3 to 5 reps at best.
Yeah. And also, what I've found in my own experience playing around with it a lot of it depends on how heavy the first set is. Like, if I only get 8 reps to failure on the main set, I'll get like 8-3-1.
Exactly.
Whereas if I get like 15 reps on the first set, I'll go like 15-5-3-2. It depends on the muscle group, depends on the exercise. It's not as much for me. I don't get as big of drops on isolation movements as, say, like a hammer chest press. That's because my triceps personally give out on the chest press compared to a tricep pushdown that's more isolated. So when you take a minute, those first few repetitions are easy again because you're getting enough recovery. Not full recovery if you took 2 minutes, but with 15 seconds, you're not. It's basically just to give you a little bit of a break. We go back to that idea of you're fatiguing during the set, 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You get to here at 8. If you rest to 15 seconds, your force production only comes back to here initially. Whereas if you rest a minute, it's coming way back up.
As far as training effectiveness, why, if you only rest, let's say, a minute and you've gained back 30 units of force production, why can't you just go do your next set and let's say you take it up to failure. Now you're going to get fewer reps.
Right.
But again, for people wondering, why is that less effective physiologically than resting adequately to recover? I mean, if it's the beginning of your workout, you're going to recover all of the force production that you had in that first set.
It seems to be, when you look at the couple studies that have looked at this, it's simply that the weight drops are so massive. Like the absolute mechanical tension just keeps dropping and dropping and dropping.
Yeah.
So that like the total, again, do it with a minute rest. Like unless you're dropping the weight quickly, you're going to be going like 10, 6, 2 repetitions. You're just not getting the same amount of mechanical work unless you drop the weight enormously. Like this is a really...
And could you look at that through the lens of effective reps? Even your effective reps are going down?
I think so, because you're getting enough recovery between the sets to be starting at a higher force level, but then there's also just there is a cumulative fatigue, but it's more metabolic, it's more acidotic that's occurring in some like fibers. I mean, it's a good question, and I think I'm basically hand waving it away, but I'm just telling you that like that's what the studies have seen.
Yeah,
when they compare.
I mean, practically also, if you're using heavier weights, so let's say if you're working in the rep range of 4 to 8, or certainly let's say 4 to 6, if you take that first set close to failure and you rest a minute, I mean, you're going to get...
You'll drop about...
3 maybe on that second set.
Sure.
Maybe even two. If it's a 4, that might even turn into a 1 to 2.
Ken Leister wrote about that one time. He had a workout because he was very HIT proponent. He was like, take your first set to failure and rest 60 seconds. You will either drop half the reps or have to cut the weight and have to maintain the rep range.
Yeah.
Loads drop so rapidly under those conditions. I mean, that can happen even with higher repetitions where you're having to adjust the load to keep the repetition range, depending on what you're talking about. But in the paper that kind of looked at this, they were trying to equate the total like work volume in terms of like the total volume load, which is weight times sets times weight times reps total, and to equate the volume load they had to do 50% more volume.
Yeah.
So I, you know, it is that just whatever the total amount of the work, whatever amount of stimulus that is. So it's like, yeah, there are still questions. Make no mistake. To me, the effective reps is the best model we have now, but that doesn't mean that it won't be replaced. It just seems to be the only way I can rationalize all the different systems of training, all the different sets and volumes. When you look at all the studies in the aggregate, the ones that seem, you know, to require higher volumes are using short rest intervals, are using lower quality training, whereas the ones that aren't, it actually goes back to the reps and reserve thing. I vaguely recall James Steele and James Fisher, who are kind of on the HIT, the high intensity training failure end of things, in the studies they've done on estimating reps and reserve, people are way better at it on machines than they are on, say, a squat.
Sure.
Because again, anyone who's done high rep squats, you have, I have, I've grinded out 20s for you. I did it for forever till I burnt out on it. It's generally systemic fatigue.
Yeah. Same thing with deadlifting.
You are breathing, you are gasping, you are breathing yeah. like a freight train. It is not local muscular fatigue, whereas nothing hurts more than high rep leg extensions with short rest intervals because it is so localized. Like I said, so if you're doing these studies that are like, oh yeah, we did, you know, 15 sets or however many sets of squats on a short rest interval, I guarantee by the end they're stopping that much shorter failure because it's central. It is volitional or technical. Also, with short rest intervals on complex movements, your technique falls apart.
Yep.
Leg extensions just hurt. But on squats, I had a buddy who tried it, and he's a highly trained squatter, Olympic lifter. And he's like, yeah, I tried to do 8 sets of 10 on 90 seconds, and by set 4, like, I mean, he's built for squatting. He's like, I couldn't do it. I couldn't get best rep 4, no matter how much I lighten the load. So yeah, it's like that. So that's kind of the best I can come up with. And I guess the only other question, I know you had one thing you wanted to bring up, and we've got hopefully a few more minutes. Like, how close to failure you need to be? Like, yeah. How many reps in reserve?
Yeah, practically now. So people are thinking, right? So what modifications should I be making in my training, if any? But, you know, how should I be thinking about this for tomorrow's workout kind of thing? You know?
Right. Well, so the first thing I would say for most people is you got to find out where it actually is. Because I can say for the grand majority of people, what they think muscular failure is and what it true muscular, physiological muscular failure, I can almost guarantee them that what they think it is not what it is. And I've been on the internet a long time. I know everyone trains harder than any 10 trainees, but I also know what I've seen in the gym. And unless the internet is the magical unicorn trainees that I have somehow never come across. I mean, whatever. When I've been in high-level powerlifting gyms, that's a very different thing. But if you're talking about the average trainee, they are not training as hard as they think. I mean, and you brought this up earlier, and I would also say this. If you physically can do 15 sets for a muscle group, by definition, you're not training as intensely as you think because it cannot physically be done. I can drop anybody in 2 or 3 truly all-out sets. I mean, like, will not be able to get up off the floor. And again, I'm not saying this is how you should train. I'm making a point. If you're ever in Austin, trust me, I'll prove it to you. There was a research group that put up some videos of what they were doing in their studies one time. And they did it. They had someone do a set of leg press to true failure. The guy finished the rep and just rolled out of the machine and collapsed on the floor. You're telling me you could do 15 sets of that. You're lying to me and you're lying to yourself. So the first thing is that, and what I would recommend—
Then go into the hospital with rhabdo.
Yeah, exactly. Like I'm not, you know, Dorian Yates has put up some videos of him. He trains people now and like watch him take people to a true all-out set of leg presses. And that person will collapse on the floor afterwards. It cannot be done for a high volume by definition. So the first thing people need to do is figure out where that is. And like, to your point, pick an isolation movement, pick a bicep curl, something you're not going to get hurt on, and just do rep after rep after rep. When it starts to move a little bit slower, dig it in, keep it moving. Every rep you get, lower it, big breath, try another one until it physically will not move, until no matter how much effort you're exerting. Now compare that to what you previously thought was your limits. Or, like, the problem is if I go, you know, estimate, pick a weight to go, oh, yeah, I think I could do 10 reps with those. And then just see, just do rep after rep after rep. I remember this football coach one time, his coach, and he said, yeah, he went and asked his male and female athletes to estimate their 10 RM. And without fail, the men way overestimated how much weight they could do. And the women were like 50%. And I'm not, again, this isn't meant to be some like commentary on gender. Studies show that everyone is about half of what they think they are.
Men tend to be more egotistical than women.
Yeah, very much.
I don't think that's a controversial statement.
Yeah, I don't want people.
I think that's biological.
Yes, I don't want people to hear me going, women are weak and don't push hard. Because in my experience.
No, I think it's just less ego, I think is what it is.
Yes, exactly. I just want to make sure the message is not being. In my experience, once women learn to push hard, they push harder than men in my, depending on the movement, regardless.
So well, they are built to push babies out, which is. I came across some research on that some time ago that basically the conclusion was that the researchers, they couldn't explain how women could survive that much pain, that biologically the amount of pain that a woman experiences on average in childbirth should kill them, but somehow it doesn't.
Yeah. And I agree. And there was another data set back in the day that was like, women have lower pain tolerances than men, but it's very stimulus specific. Mm. It's like, yes, put their hands in cold water. And that's one thing, is women do run colder, but in other situations, it's absolutely the opposite. And it has to be. And then I would tell someone, okay, you've just done that all out set of bicep curls or pushdowns or machine chest press something. Go, okay, now think back to the last, like take your final failure rep and sort of look back at the previous three or four reps. What were the movement dynamics? Usually about 3 to 4 reps, it starts to slow down a little bit. You're having to exert a little more effort. So if you made it to 15 and you think back, all right, at rep 11, that was 4 reps reserve. You've now learned a very valuable thing. Now, for me, what I've noticed is it seems to be exercise specific.
Yeah.
There's some movements for me that are just like 8, 9, 10, done. For whatever reason, shoulder seems to fail real quickly for reasons.
Any pressing for me is that.
Yeah, and that could be because triceps are giving out or a stabilizer, whereas like leg extensions are just for me, chest just grinds and grinds and then it'll just barely make it through the sticking point. And you do to a degree have to determine it, given exercise, given muscle group, maybe it's fiber type. I don't know. It is what it is. But you need to first get an idea of like, all right, I would generally say if the bar doesn't slow a little bit, maybe not max, but if it doesn't, you look at the average set, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, grindy, grindy, grindy. It didn't slow. You're not even within 4 reps to failure. Yeah. You're not even four reps in reserve, rather. And going to what you said about, I watch people in the commercial gym, in my gym, for me to see anyone take a set to where it slows down a little bit is rare. I mean, I'll see it.
Gym, it's just the more experienced weightlifters, generally. Those are the only ones.
I'll see it. And it's usually people doing certain movements and usually they're going very heavy. Like I'll watch someone back squatting, and they'll have 3 wheels on each side and they'll usually go to like the first bar speed drop or maybe a rep in there. And again, I'm not saying it's not generally safe to grind squats to limit failure, but if it didn't slow down at all, I can guarantee you that you're kind of nowhere close to what your true reps and reserve are. And at least some of the early studies did find that 3 to 4 reps and reserve seemed to be about the range. And again, if we go back to that effective rep model, in a submaximal set, in a higher rep set, you're not going to even approach full recruitment till about that point.
Yeah.
Now you may get more recruitment as you go, but beyond a certain point, recruitment is maximized. And also the idea that people can't max recruit all their muscle fibers is untrue. But regardless, like if it doesn't slow at all, I can guarantee you did not recruit those high threshold fibers at all.
This is one of the reasons why I have personally always enjoyed, or for a long time now, heavier training, let's say in that rep range of 4 to 8 reps. And I've seen it now anecdotally work very well with many, many people. Partly one of the reasons, because I think it helps mitigate the mistake of just not training hard enough. Because when you have to do a set of 6 or 7 or 8, if you are there, if you're paying attention at all in terms of your load, there are going to be some effective reps in there. Maybe you're not, yes. maybe you're not pushing to a true one RIR or zero RIR.
Right. You're not saying you have.
Maybe it's actually a two or three, but you did get some effective training in
yes,
there.
Absolutely.
Because
yes,
the weight was heavy enough. You didn't make the mistake of you were supposed to do 20 reps and you were supposed to go to a zero or one RIR and you ended that at an eight RIR. Okay.
Yes,
you did another warm-up set. Great.
Yes, I agree with you completely. Most people you watch in the gym are just doing repeat warm-up sets.
Yep.
The bar is never, and that's why they can do so much volume. But even with that, like maybe with short rest intervals, they might, because of cumulative fatigue, start to get, but even with that, right? Like, let's say you're doing
that loses its efficacy quickly. I mean, I made that mistake before I knew what I was doing many years ago.
We all did. I think we can
no adaptations to speak of really sure. for years.
Yes. I think we could also get into the issue of, you know, junk volume and you're generating, all you're doing is extra work. Like that was part of Dante's philosophy. And again, I'm not saying this is universally right. He believed that volume was what overtrained you. And there is an element of truth to that. He wanted to generate the maximum stimulus in the least volume possible. That was sort of his underlying philosophy of dog prep. And again, not recommending it. It burns a lot of people out. Not everyone has the mindset or the drive to do that. And you don't have to. There are multiple paths to the goal. But I can say with some degree of certainty, if you are never getting to the point where the bar is slowing at least somewhat, you're not getting anywhere close to an effective rep. Now, yeah, if you go to the first bar speed drop and that's four reps in reserve, you might need to do a higher volume, and that's fine. It's not my preference because I'm old and I'm in maintenance and I don't want to be in the gym that long anymore. I'm built for failure. I prefer intensity, so I gravitate towards the low. Again, I'm also in maintenance and have been for years. My trainee is an elite female powerlifter. I don't take her to failure because I have to worry about systematic fatigue between day to day to day, but I take her close. I mean, she's within a couple of reps. And if you start to look at the research, typically what you see is 3 to 4 reps in reserve is about the minimum intensity. And that would be your first bar speed drop under most conditions. Some of it does find that that with greater proximity to failure as 4, 3, 2, 1 reps in reserve, there is frequently more growth. And then at least one of the review papers, you might have by Eric Helms and a couple of others, they contended that going to true failure could be a negative due to excessive neuromuscular fatigue, and that gets to a whole separate issue. Because I remain unconvinced that somehow 3 sets to failure causes excessive neuromuscular fatigue, but 26 sets of quads is somehow less fatiguing. But when you compare 3 sets of 10 to failure to 6 sets of 5 at the same weight, well, yeah, you've compared 3 work sets to 6 warm-ups. I have no doubt that the failure is more fatigue. But again, I'm not saying you should go to failure. You frequently do see bigger repetition drops set to set to set with failure. RPE, ready for perceived exertion, is maximum. Not everyone's good for that. But you need to know where it is first. And once you know where it is, somewhere between 0 and 4 is going to be the sweet spot as far as I'm concerned. And you're going to simply have to compensate by adjusting volume. Base, you know, as you get closer to 0, you're going to be able to and need to do less volume. And as you get farther from 0, you're going to need proportionally more volume. And again, even if we don't think of it in terms of effective reps, even within that reps reserve, I think that starts to eliminate the supposed contradictions in different training systems. Yeah, if you want to do 15 sets at 4 reps reserve, cool. You want to do 4 sets at 0 reps reserve, cool. You want to do 8 sets at 2 reps in reserve, big picture stuff, it's probably going to be a wash in the long term. I mean, even go back and look at, you know, Arnold and those guys, they trained hard. You know, they would do 15, 20 sets per muscle group, many of which were warm-ups. But if you look at their actual work sets, they went till it started to slow and they didn't grind, you know. Then you had Dorian and he would only do 4 work sets to failure, but make no mistake, at least, you know, he'd do like 3 or 4 warm-ups because you're not going to go to a hammer incline press and throw 4 wheels per side and do that cold. You know, probably if we went in and tried to add it up, he was probably getting a little bit more, but his 4 limit sets, truly the limit, and he usually had his partner help him through the last couple, were probably the physiologically equivalent of Arnold's 15 or Lee Haney, who was kind of in the middle. He said, stimulate, don't annihilate. He was kind of mid-range volume, not going to Dorian level intensity, going a little bit harder than Arnold intensity. You look at naturals, it all kinds of comes out in the wash in the long term. And there are other systems that are more periodized, and you've mentioned this. We're frequently early in the cycle. You may be going 3 to 4 reps reserve so that you're, and then as the weights go up, and presumably they're going up a little bit faster than you're adapting, a couple weeks in, you might be in the 3 reps reserve range. A couple weeks in, you're in the 0 to 1 reps reserve range. That way it gets grindy, then you stop and start over again. One thing I often recommend, and this goes back to something you said, and then we can wrap it up. Since most people, even if you know what failure is, I like the way you put it. You got to keep yourself honest sometimes. You'll have someone, let's say they're doing 4 sets of 8 to 10, supposedly 2 reps in reserve. Maybe they'll get a little lazy. Every few workouts, take that final set and do an AMRAP, as many reps as possible. Yep. Take it as, like, don't do it on the first set, because then the next 3 sets will be very bad. You know, get your work in on that 4th set. Go all out. Till, again, safe movement, till it will not move any further. And see what happens. If you were supposed to be in an 8 to 10 rep range, and you only got 12, well, you're perfect. You're right where you need to be. You're at 2 reps in reserve. Don't change anything. And if you get 15 reps on that final set, you need to stop sandbagging, add a little weight to the bar next time. And again, I'm not saying do that every workout. Add some weight. You'll be right where you need to be. Every few workouts, keep yourself honest. And then especially the intermediate or even the advanced level, because not everyone's good at reps in reserve. Again, it is a skill, but even with that, my trainee, I've asked her reps in reserve or RPE, and it for her, it's easy, 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 hard. She does, once it gets past a certain point, it's all hard. She's terrible at it.
Yeah.
So I don't do it anymore.
You mentioned also some people fail very quickly. I think of one of the guys who works with
me. Some people are very
He's awful. Always been very strong, very explosive, and then fails. It's weird to watch. And he knows how to work, and he's not afraid to push to failure, blah, blah, blah. That's just physiologically. He'll put 315 on incline bench, and it's just rep, fail. Yep. It's odd, actually.
I had a training partner, and I don't know if it's neurological or fiber typing, where it is very much a go, no-go thing. Some people have great grind. Some people, and he'd be in the middle of a set, and I'd be in it, just be like, just exactly like you said. And suddenly, everything would just shut off for whatever reason. But that's another reason that you kind of have to do this. I also don't think that's the average training.
No. I mean, there's like a spectrum. That's the extreme. And then you maybe have the extreme grinder.
All they see is these rep slowdowns occurring in a fairly consistent manner. And there's variability on the exercise on the person. But again, you don't know until you know. Until you've actually tried to do the next repetition, you will not know for you personally. Comparing between individuals is a fool's game. It's a matter of you figuring out for you. It may depend on the movement, the exercise, but until you've figured it out, you will not know. Then you can decide. And if you want to follow a established training program that puts you at, on average, 2 to 3 reps in reserve, cool. Now you know what that actually means. But most people who think they're at 4 reps in reserve, based on what I've seen, more like 8. And doing it every so often at the intermediate level, where you may not be adding weight rapidly, every 3 or 4 weeks, just test it out and see where you're at. Especially if you're just not good at it, if you're not good at knowing your reps in reserve, or it's one of those movements that just fails really quickly for you. Just do it. Do an all-out set, last set of an exercise. That'll let you gauge it. Something else, and then we'll definitely wrap. This was a recent one that Eric Helms did. And I forget it was an intervention study or a review, and it pointed out that, look, most people suck at those. My words, not their language. Most people are bad at this. And it's that it may be important for these studies to do a sort of not a break-in workout, but sort of like a familiarization to teach people what actual 0 reps in reserve are. Because otherwise, telling them to stop at 2 reps in reserve means nothing in any of the, unless they happen to be really experienced, and really experienced people don't typically go into these. They're not the typical subjects. Because again, I don't care if they're a college student who's got 4 years of training. I've watched these people train, and the grand majority of them.
I was once a college aged male with 4 years of training, and I didn't
look.
I wouldn't have been very useful in that study of 2 reps in reserve, go squat to 2 reps in reserve. Okay, sure.
Look, I don't want anybody listening to this to think that I'm being like some utterly self-superior, you know, on high, we all went through it.
Yeah.
I went through, the difference was I got very involved with like the old Hargainer philosophy, just because that was my mentor early on, which is more low volume and more intensity. So once I got through college, where I guarantee you, I did the same stuff as everybody listening to those, because we all went through it, right? It was like, oh, you know, I was dumb and I read the magazines. We all did. We didn't know any better. You can't know what you don't know. And through that, the focus was on low volume, higher intensity. And I did a lot of training like that. And that happens to be like, and I was a good endurance athlete. I know how to hurt, because you have to be to go an hour all out. And so I'm very good at it, but not everybody's built for it. Psychologically, physically, physiologically, not all movements lend themselves to it. Look, your whole workout doesn't necessarily have to be like this, right? Because people, again, when I say these things, people go, well, you like failure. Because have I ever said that anywhere? No. What I'm saying is you got to know where it is. That's very different than advocating it, but it's also movement specific, right? Let's say I'm training someone and they want a bench, and okay, on bench press, they might use sets of five at an 8 RM, right? Keep it technically solid, keep the quality up, keep the bar speed up. They're a power lifter. They're doing triples at a 5 RM, right? I'm not going to push them to grindy failure unless we're at that point in the cycle. We get a little work in. Okay, now we're going to go do some body buffing work. Now we're going to go do a machine chest press. And maybe I want to get a little more volume, and I'll have them do 4 sets of 8 at a 10 RM, right? We're going to get some, and then I want to burn them out. We're going to go to the crossover, go to the cable crossover, pec deck, 2 sets, don't stop until it doesn't move. There's nothing that says these are mutually exclusive, which is another thing that people tend to think or get that conclusion. Like, you can do a mixture of those. Depending on, like I said, the exercise. I'm not going to have someone squat till they get pinned at the bottom.
Yeah.
By and large, I'm going to leg press them a lot closer to limits. And when I want to just torch their quads and make sure, I'm going to have them go till it doesn't move anymore. And I'll adjust the volume as we go.
Let me interject. Yeah, I have 2 more questions before we wrap up, just because I'm just curious as to your thoughts. So the first question is when you're talking about going until the weight doesn't move, that looks differently with different exercises. So you take a leg press, and inevitably what's going to happen is you're going to go to depth, and that's going to be the end. You can't press it up. However, if I think of any sort of pulling exercise, especially if it's a machine pull, I was just pulling today. So I'm thinking of sets today where I'm pulling until I can get a half rep. Now, right. That's it. There's no full contraction that's happening. Sure. That I'm stuck here basically, yes. And that's where I end the set. Or I think of a pec deck where maybe you can get it. It's going, but you get to here and you're just like, ugh.
Yeah.
Just for people listening, so they understand. Would you consider those points failure? Now,
oh, yeah.
It's kind of a half rep. I could just go back up, and then I could do another little. Maybe it's a quarter rep now. You know.
Right. And this is, you know, and we can get into those sorts of like weird pedantic arguments.
I know it is a bit fussy, but I just wanted to mention it for people wondering. Yes.
And absolutely. It is the inability to complete a full repetition despite giving maximal effort. And if that's where you get stuck, you know, if you're doing a Heimer high, and it's.
That's exactly what I was doing. Yeah.
And that's it. And no matter how hard you pull, I mean, it's just not moving. That's failure. If you're doing a chest press, it's just like, and usually it's, you know, at the sticking point. And you're like, that would be the definition of physiological muscular failure in that context. Like, then again, we could spend another getting into the weeds of like, this is the issue with biomechanics. And really what we're talking about is an inability to get to the sticking point. And you could technically do more partial reps at the bottom, or someone helped you to the top and you could do top partial rep. And like, that's just a bunch of semantics to try to get it. And that's just detail stuff. But if you're doing a compound movement, failure will occur when you're unable to complete the full range of repetition. Because even that, you have to define like task failure. You have to define what you mean by that, right? Like that's in the research, they talk about this. And it's, you know, like, so in endurance training, you're riding a bike, you're trying to maintain 200 watts. And you can no longer maintain 200 watts. You can still do 190, right? Even in the gym, you can do drop sets. Yeah. Like it's not, failure doesn't mean the muscle is exhausted.
Yep.
It can still generate force. It can't generate enough force to complete a full range of motion, which usually means being unable to get it through the sticking point. There's all these other variables and stuff. But in the most general sense, absolutely.
Okay, good. And that's a good segue into
15-second rest. Then you can, you know, with a tiny bit of recovery, you can do a few more repetitions and then it'll, you know, it'll go 8-3-1 and then you're cooked, where each set is still being defined in the same way, an inability to complete a full repetition. So yes.
That's a good segue to my next question, which is what are your thoughts on, I guess it could be referred to as beyond failure training. So here's how even this is, it seems to be having a bit of a resurgence.
Really?
Okay. Right now on social media and elsewhere, I see more people talking about Mensur's training principles.
Yeah.
But what I'll see is things like I'll see forced reps. So, you know, I'm doing my hammer pull and I'm stuck here and I have my buddy now taking a little bit of load off it so I can, you know, force through that rep. Or I'll see it, let's say I'm on the leg extension now and I'm doing my reps and I go to failure. And then now I'm resting not 10 or 15 seconds. I'm resting just a few seconds, three to 5 seconds. And then I grind out another one. And then I wait another 3 to 5 seconds. What are your thoughts on these types of techniques?
Well, it depends. Like, I'm not a huge fan because I think they get overused. But again, it's a matter of like, okay, you have to incorporate that with volumes. Because going back to the slightly assisted rep, you're trying to do a bench press. As far as 100 units of force, you can only do 95. Assuming your training partner is not of the all you upright row approach to spotting, he gives you just enough help to get through the top. Okay, does that mean that what we defined failure as before was not really failure? Like I said, it's not that the muscle is exhausted. That's why I tend to try to be very careful in my definition, is that at least in the terms of just defining concentric muscular failure, it is the inability, maybe we should put it, you know, voluntarily or by yourself to do a full repetition. But like, yeah, if you keep the volume low, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm not a big, you know, you do like heavy eccentrics and you do forced repetitions where somebody's helping you a little bit to get through it in very small amounts, maybe. You know, where you're getting that extra rep or two. I think the Chinese Olympic lifting coaches do that to help their lifters get a little bit more out of squats. They give that little bit of help to the top to get a little, although some of that's probably safety, just to get them to the top so they can rack the thing. So I'm not a huge fan, more because of the way people use them, which is they try to do it on top of high volumes of training.
Yep.
You're doing, you know, if you want to do 3 all-out sets, and you know you can recover and get that little, or do it on a final set to get a little bit of extra work, that's fine. If you're doing it, you know, Dorian did, but he also did 4 total work sets once a week. And if you go watch his videos, his training partner gave him that little bit of help on the leg extension just to get those final couple through the sticking point, just enough to keep it moving, but he did very low volumes. So it's a matter of use. Like, I don't personally generally do that with people, but somebody wants to do it, just keep the volume low. If you're going to do 15 sets and do 4 reps on every set, you're going to have a bad time. As far as, you know, doing that little bit of extra rest between repetitions. Yeah, we all do that too, as it gets a little harder to get that.
At least 1 or 2 seconds, you catch your breath and you're going for it.
That 1 pound back of, you know, that one unit back of force ability that allows you to get that next repetition a little bit easier. And like, yeah, if you want to get really, really, really anal compulsive about it, you can follow another definition I've seen, which I truly don't like, is an inability to maintain the target rep speed, because that by definition is ensuring that from a hypertrophy standpoint, sports training is totally different. We're talking about maintaining quality and bar speed. That is a completely different thing. From a hypertrophy standpoint, you're like, oh, your goal is a 2-second rep. As soon as you go slower than that, that's failure. The only thing you failed on is making that a productive set. Like, I think that's just the dumbest one. But yeah, you take, you know, an extra second to catch your breath. You usually see that on like leg press and hack squats because it's more systemically fatiguing. Got the old breathing squat where that was deliberately part of it to allow you to work and get more total work at that same weight. But it was also only one set. We're trading intensity in this sense, or the total, you know, work stimulus per set for volume. In that sense, I suppose, I just typically see it being misused, and I don't know, you know, for the average person. Just, you know, just don't do it a lot. I definitely don't like, you know, pure eccentrics. You know, people help you to the top, or you'll see people, like, I mean, I'm, you know, doing a leg extension where they hold it at the top and you try to physically force them to the bottom and stuff like that. Like, there are easier ways to tear muscle. I've been doing it that way. But again, as an every once in a while thing, maybe it is funny that
or not, it sounds like.
Yeah,
like or just stick to straight sets and take them close to failure. And...
Yeah, getting within 1 to 4 reps reserve, adjust your volume. If you, you know, to me, again, watching the average gym, that's usually a young kid thing on bench press, having your buddy, you know, all you upright row, bench spot, bounce off the chest type stuff. I think if you look at people, you know, in the long term, that we're looking at longevity of training, you're not seeing a lot of that being done or being done sporadically, you know, do it every, like we talked about, if you want to do an all out grinder set in 3 or 4 weeks to keep yourself honest, great, all for it. Unless you're going to keep volume very low, I wouldn't do it all the time. But again, we've got this. It's the other thing I find really frustrating about the industry is during these debates, and I get it, social media, we can't have nuance. People are treating these variables as independent. Oh, well, there's frequency, there's volume, there's intensity, there's reps and reserve. These all factor in. If you want to train higher frequency for whatever reason, you have to keep either the volume lower per workout or the intensity lower, which may mean more volume per workout. If you want to train at a higher intensity, you must do lower volumes. By the same token, if you want to do lower volumes, then you don't have time. I don't want to be in the gym anymore. I don't enjoy it. I've been doing this for too long. I'm only going to go and do a couple sets. I have to, if you're only going to do 2 sets, you got to work to failure or very close to it.
Yeah.
If you want to do 20 sets, you cannot work close to failure. I wouldn't personally do that, but some people, whatever. The gym is their hobby. I think there's more productive things to do with your life. There's lots of good video games out there. Go play Pal World, right? Like, but if that's what somebody wants to do, then so like there's all these interacting variables. You know, if you're going to be at 4 reps reserve, you're going to need to do proportionally more volume to compensate for that. If you're going to be at 0, you need to do less. If you want to do high volumes, you got to bring the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's all these competing variables. And in the discussions, you just don't, like sitting with a neuromuscular fatigue thing, the studies are comparing equivalent volumes. 3 sets of 10 to 6 sets of 5. No, I want to show me 3 sets of 10 to 15 sets of 8 to 10 RM. Are you really going to tell me that the 3 by 10 to failure is more fatiguing than fit? Like, let's compare real world training. I get it. It's science. It's got to be controlled. I understand why they do it. But when I see people in this industry go, oh, training to failure is too neuromuscular fatiguing. And they go, but somehow 45 sets to failure for 8 straight weeks or 52 sets per week. Oh, no, we love that study. Fine. Explain to me the contradiction. Explain to me how 3 sets of 10 to failure is bad and 26 sets of quads twice a week. That's there's no consistency to it. Not to mention the fact that even if 3 sets of 10 makes your vertical jump worse for 48 hours, why does this matter for bodybuilders who only train a muscle group twice a week or once a week?
Yeah,
I've yet to see that explained either. But the point of this all being is that there are all these interactions between volume, frequency, intensity, whereas intensity I'm using here being proximity to failure, not percentages or any of that other stuff.
And I think for most people listening, the recipe that is going to serve them best. And so this is people who, let's say that take a guy, he wants to gain probably 25 to 30 pounds of muscle over the entirety of his weightlifting career. And he wants to have some abs. Take a woman, she wants to gain maybe 15-ish pounds to the right, you know, in the right places. And she wants to be relatively lean, but still look feminine. For those people, you have moderate volume, moderate to high intensity, probably moderate to maybe even low to moderate frequency is an approach that will get them there. And that you mentioned longevity, and that's a lot of people listening. They care about not just getting jacked at any cost. They want to get kind of jacked, but they also want to stay fit and healthy, and they want to be able to do this for the rest of their life without breaking.
Yes.
So that's generally the approach I've tried to recommend to those people. Now, as you said, strength athletes, that's something else. Sure. People who want to become bodybuilders, that's something else.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, at the extreme, but even with that, just a final story, Matt Gary, who's a powerlifting, he's apparently the coach of the US powerlifting team, which is a thing. And he's even said that, especially in powerlifting, like longevity is important if you want to stay in the sport. And he says, he'll get people that come to him and go, can you put 50 kilos on my total in 8 weeks? I go, well, maybe, probably, but it might break you and you'll probably quit afterwards, right? And that's the other thing. Again, I like science. I believe in research. I think it's important. But when you look at these papers, they're like, oh, for 12 weeks, we did this one thing and saw this growth. Well, that's great. But what about the long term? What about, you know, you have to 12 weeks is great, but what about over the next year? What about over this given time frame and the long term? And I think, you know, I've watched the industry went through volume for 5 years. I think it's interesting that Mike Mentzer's we're coming back into the intensity range. Yep. I've been sort of middle, you know, middle of the road most of the time, where it's like moderate volumes, hard enough without grinding you into dirt or getting you hurt, which allows progression over time, allows you to have a life. We're not talking about wanting to be elite bodybuilders. It seems like after every wave in the industry, we all kind of come back to that, right? If you look at those general research-supported 10 to 20 sets a week, depending on how heavy you're going, once, you know, I tend to prefer a little bit higher frequency twice a week per muscle group. I know people have made good gains once a week. Women may need a little bit higher frequency than men, neither here nor there. Somewhere between 0 and 4 reps in reserve, depending on the volume, the exercise, the personality type, which is something that doesn't get considered. Do you know, if you look at successful hypertrophy programs and the coaches that I see having success in the long term, you know, as much as I think success leaves clues is very trite and silly, there is some truth to it. If you look at Dog Crap, Meyer Reps, Brian Haycock's hypertrophy specific training that nobody probably remembers, my generic bulking routine, what you typically see is roughly 8 to 12 week training cycles where the goal is to set progressively smaller, you know, small PRs over that duration. Then you back cycle and do it again and back, look at, you know, Scott Stevens fortitude training. It's all kind of it. And we all seem to sort of come back to that every few years as people get super excited about one thing or the other. I mean, like, yeah, for most people, doing some mentor style training every once in a while would not be a bad idea because that'll teach them where to learn, you know, learn where
you'll know what failure is. That's for sure.
You'll know what failure is training next time. And that burns you out. You know, you can go back and we could make super hand waving arguments. You know, there's that old, the best workout is the one you're not doing. And which taken to the logical extreme means that whatever workout you're doing today in the gym is no longer the best workout. You should change your workout. Now the workout you're doing, you should change your workout again during the workout, which is me being dumb. But people are like, oh, when I change to a different style of training, I seem to start growing again. And I think, A, it may just be psychological. People get bored doing the same thing. Yeah. But I think I could make some very hand-waving arguments. There are different components of growth in terms of nervous system function, muscle. We're now sarcoplasmic versus myofibrillar growth. I think it's possible at the higher levels that you could see rate-limiting systems. And when you change to a different system, maybe, or maybe it's just variety.
I mean, the details of a change matter, too. I mean, what are you changing from? You're changing from a bunch of 20-rep sets that actually are kind of a bunch of warm-up sets, and now you're doing a bunch of 6 or 8-rep sets that are actually pretty hard. Well, then you would expect better results.
And then everyone, you know, you see people that are doing lots of low volume training and they go back to moderately higher volumes and maybe they recover or make better or whatever it is. Some of it's just variety. A lot of studies on diet find that people lose weight initially just because they're more attentive to doing something new. And you can't deny that again for the general jacked population. Athletes will do the same stuff for a year because that's what they the focus, it's a different,
whatever makes them a better athlete, they're just going to do that.
And I'm not saying that's better or worse. I'm just saying that it is. But for the general person, you've got life that gets in the way. You have the realities of children, of these different factors that all play into it. And for them, people get bored. And if changing the workout to something, the novelty makes you work a little bit harder or differently because you're more excited about it, I have no problem with that. Wasn't for me. I can do the same thing for months on end and never get bored. But that's me. And that is, you know, the personality component tends to get ignored as people promote, well, this is what works for me. Well, and what are your goals? What is your person? If someone wants more volume, cool. I'll just make sure they're working hard enough.
Yeah.
I just won't let it. But to truly wrap this up, because I think you know, you need to get going, is most people aren't even working hard enough. Not saying you have to grind to failure unless you want to and are good at it. And that's fine. Keep your volume low. You have to know where it is. And once you know where it is, it will actually allow you to use all these awesome work at 2 to 3 reps reserve workouts, types of training programs that are out there. Like even with some of the, you know, the AIs that are like, oh, put in your RPE and your reps in reserve. Yeah, good luck. The people that are good at that don't use these apps. The people that are using these apps don't have any clue what their true RPE or reps in reserve is.
I don't even know which apps you're referring to. I haven't played.
There were spreadsheets and stuff. There was old one as like a powerlifting spreadsheet. It was like, oh, you know, put in your RPE or reps reserve on your squats and we'll adjust your weight week to week, which is dumb.
Got it.
Stuff like that. It's like, look, the people that are good enough at doing this don't use these apps. People using these apps don't know what they're...
The psychological subjective element too, enters too much variability. It's just it's not that simple.
And until you get good at judging rep speed and really knowing that by doing it for a while, you don't know. But it's so funny to me that because I actually talked about, well, this is what failure is, and this is why you have to know what it is. People are like, well, Lyle just advocates training to failure. Are you people... I'm not using complicated language. I said over and over and over again, I'm not saying you must train to failure. Regardless, then I look at these other training programs that are like, oh, at the end of every deadlift workout, do an AMRAP. Yeah, right. Most of these other training programs recommend going to failure. Yeah, AMRAP deadlift, sure. I mean, I've done it. I've done 20 rep deadlifts. I would never recommend it, but I've done it once. I've done deadlifts.
There was a point when I was doing AMRAPs every 3 or 4 months, but on the deadlift, it wasn't a true AMRAP. I was willing to push close. I was willing. Yeah. I mean, I was like you were saying, I mean, it's cardio by the end of the set and my quads are on fire. Everything's on fire. Yep. But could I have done at least another rep or two? Probably. But enough. I'll give myself credit for my little 1RM calculation.
Yeah. But to tell it, but it's they're saying, yeah, do an AMRAP on these movements at the end of every workout.
Yeah.
To see how to adjust the training. And I'm
that's how you burn out and break.
The supposed failure way more than I ever have. You know, do a block of it. Do a Mensur block. Figure out where it is. Do it every 3 or 4 weeks if you're an intermediate keep yourself honest. Or if you're good at it. If you're really good at reps for reserve, you may never need to.
Yep.
Because you can keep adjusting it. So I think that covers it.
Yep. Yeah. Great discussion. Everything that I wanted to cover. Why don't we wrap up with where people can find you and your work? Anything in particular you want them to know about?
So my website is and has always been bodyrecomposition.com. I've got a zillion articles. I don't update it because I'm not convinced people read websites anymore. I've got my store, which is where I sell all my books. I do consultations if you want help. With that, to set up a training type stuff. My Instagram is McDonald Lyle that I don't really use very much. I alternate between dog pictures, dad jokes, and the occasional video. I've got a very active Facebook group called, again, just search for bodyrecomposition.com. That's where you'll find me best. And I always like to point out I have a lot of very, very smart people in their field who have expertise in areas that I don't. Such as we got 5 top physios, OBGYNs. People ask these obscure medical questions, and there's always someone who's like, I'm a critical care nurse that deals with this. I'm just like, holy crap. I learn constantly from the people in my group. I have started doing YouTube videos. Again, we'll see how long that keeps up, including a Q&A. Go find in my channel. I think that one's Lyle McDonald, but you'll find me. So yeah, I mean, I've been online since it started. So it's all kind of bodyrecomposition.com.
Right. Awesome. Well, thanks again for taking the time. I look forward to doing another one.
Absolutely.
Well, I hope you liked this episode. I hope you found it helpful. And if you did, subscribe to the show because it makes sure that you don't miss new episodes. And it also helps me because it increases the rankings of the show a little bit, which of course then makes it a little bit more easily found by other people who may like it just as much as you. And if you didn't like something about this episode or about the show in general, or if you have ideas or suggestions or just feedback to share, shoot me an email, mike@muscleforlife.com, muscleforlife.com, and let me know what I could do better or just what your thoughts are about maybe what you'd like to see me do in the future. I read everything myself. I'm always looking for new ideas and constructive feedback. So thanks again for listening to this episode, and I hope to hear from you soon.